Delighted to welcome you to the third in our series of the 7-year itch, a series looking at how we can ensure that economic recovery improves the lives and circumstances of everyone in society, not just those at the top. I'm Caroline McFarland. I'm the founder and director of COVI, an independent non-partisan think tank. And we explore ideas about and for the common good and aim to make those ideas more accessible and engaging to a wider public. So as an open cinema event, this discussion tonight will begin with a filmed interview with Danny Dorling, much like a studio recording. And as the first crowdsourced think tank, we conducted a crowdfunding and crowdsourcing campaign following a launch last year. We've also crowdsourced the questions for the interview this evening, and then we'll be going to ask the audience here afterwards as well. If you're tweeting, you can also submit questions and use the hashtag 7-year itch, but you'll also have a chance to ask questions from the floor. So tonight we're joined by Danny Dorling, the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. Danny is one of Britain's leading social thinkers and commentators on social inequality, and his books and publications concern issues including housing, health, employment, education, and poverty. We're specifically talking about the book Inequality and the 1%, which is celebrated as one of the leading analyses of the financial crisis and looking at how the rich have grown ever richer. The gap between the haves and the have-nots have turned into a growing chasm, and while the rich have found new ways of protecting their wealth, everyone else has suffered the penalties of austerity. So in this book, Danny unpicks the reasons for this ever-growing economic imbalance and assesses the impact on the lives and prospects of the real economy. Before I ask Danny to join me for the interview, I'll start with just reading an excerpt from the book itself. And this is from the conclusion of the book, so quick sneak preview if you haven't had a chance to read it. Orthodox economics suggests that, in the long run, prices and incomes will come back into alignment. It also provides a bizarre justification as to why some nations are rich and others are not. Marxists say that price and value are a product of underlying social relations, not free-floating market forces. Keynesians say that in the long run, we're all dead, and thus need to do something about the short run. All should know that the rich are currently being let off the hook, all those from the bottom of the 1% up to those in control of the largest corporations. Many people argue that concerted political action, including much more effective banking regulation, is needed to address the problem of increasing inequality. A global tax on capital was seriously proposed in 2014 by Thomas Piketty, one of the world's leading economists, and the best-selling author in the US and UK that year. But successful social movements in the past, rather like victors in wars, wrote their own history and may have overstated the importance of overt politics. Campaigners want to say why they mattered. Academics want to try to influence policy and so look for evidence of their personal impact. But much change consists of gradual, almost imperceptible transformation, a slow revolution of the will, a change in the mood, a subtle shift in what becomes morally acceptable, one that is almost never due to any great leaders or great speeches. Gradual transformations and societal motivations are not easily monitored. It is often not obvious how they occurred, and usually difficult to quantify their extent. Today, another such transformation may be underway, a slow revolution in attitudes to greed. The highest ever level of concern about rising inequality in Britain was recorded by Ipsos Mori in their winter polling of 2013. Trends can form without the necessity of a lobby group or an organisation trying to profit from them. Societal motivation and changing fashion are almost synonyms. By December 2013, further polling evidence revealed that most UK voters believed any recovery was likely to favour the wealthy few rather than families like them, and that a majority favoured taxing the rich more rather than further cuts, especially to protect key services like health and education. By that year, we were no longer surprised that the majority thought this way, only that the rich still did not get it. So, recommend reading the book, but in the meantime, we have Danny Dorling here to talk about it. Danny.
I'll just get you count to 10, not the
most difficult
question you'll get. Go ahead.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
That's perfect. Okay.
And if you could look at the camera, right, I'm a bit tempted to the audience,
so I'll
just wait for...
Sorry, audience. I'm not being rude.
For questions in a second, but first, inequality and the 1%. Talk us through the content of your book, your rationale for writing it, and where you think this debate has got to since writing it.
Okay, the rationale for writing it wasn't because the Occupy movement came along and they came up with a phrase, the 99% and the 1%. It was much less romantic than that. It was because I was doing a paper for the Journal of the Royal Statistical Society, and I was looking at the incomes of the 0.01%, the 0.1%, the 1%, the 10%, and the rest of the 90%. And I noticed that around about 2007, 2008, the 1% and those above them, the best off one in 100 people, began to pull away from the rest. Up until then, for 100 years, the 1% had travelled with the rest of the best off 10%. So when Britain became more equal, the 1% obviously had to lose money, but they lost it with the 10% beneath them. When inequalities rose from around about 1979 onwards, the 1% started to pull away, but they dragged the rest of the 10% up with them. And it was possible then for a large group of people at the top, if you like, to get enough votes for inequality to increase with a democratic mandate, as long as you managed to convince enough people lower down that they were going to get into that group as well. But then from 2008, the people just beneath the 1% began to see their incomes not rise or even fall. The 99% actually came together. The Institute of Fiscal Studies said that we had got back to the early 90s in terms of equality, as long as you've got the 1%. The 1% began to pull off. The ones at the bottom, earning about £200,000, only saw quite modest increases, but real increases while everybody else was losing. The ones at the top doubled their wealth in about 5 years. So everybody in the 1% did much better, but the 1% also became rapidly more unequal.
And so what are the implications of this sort of inequality? In the book, you talk about the various ways in which the 1% benefit, but then maybe... that has ripples and repercussions.
What's the effect for everybody else? Inequality causes problems for everybody. So highly unequal, rich societies have a lot more social problems than highly equal, rich societies. And there's a huge variation between the 25 richest countries of the world. Most are pretty equal. It's really only the USA, Singapore, us, Israel and Portugal, sometimes Portugal's now become more equal, which are highly unequal. But we have much higher rates of crime, higher rates of imprisonment, infant mortality rates are higher, mental health is worse, education is also, we can go on and on. That's the long-term story about inequality. The most recent story is what happens when this very bizarre thing occurs of only a few people doing well. And then you get all kinds of justifications for why it's okay for that to happen, why everybody else has to take a hit and suffer with austerity except for this small group at the top, why we shouldn't worry about landlords making, I think it's £400 billion of increased profit since 2008, because of course rents have risen dramatically, landlords have bought more homes and more flats. And you need to be careful when you say landlords. Most landlords actually are not in the 1%. Most landlords are amateur landlords trying to do one buy-to-let flat and not doing it very well. But from the point of view of tenants, most landlords are because the successful landlords have many properties, and they're the ones who know not to look after the properties too well, to charge to maximum, don't feel bad about chucking people out of their homes if you can make a bit more money. And those are the kind of things that go wrong. So, for instance, we had less than 10% of families who have children in private rented around about 2000. We've now got a quarter of all the families in England with children are living in private rented accommodation. In London, it's much, much higher. The majority of children in poverty in London are now, suddenly, this has happened very rapidly, they've now got a landlord. And they're being moved on average every 2 years. They're being in effect evicted because the rents are going up. So you've got children in London moving school every 2 years. You couldn't make up a more disastrous educational policy. It's hard to think of one. And that's just one of the many examples of things that begin to go rapidly wrong if a small group not only takes so much, but begins to take more and more and more.
So why the 1%? I know that you attribute the 99% to someone else in the book, but why the 99% and the 1%? Why not the 98% and the 2%?
Why not? It could, if you're being really nerdy, it could be the 98.7% and the 1.3%, you know, but that wouldn't sell so well as a book. You know, inequality in the 1.3% really wouldn't work. It's that division. It's the division between people getting to the top of fairly good careers. I mean, the 1% in the past is always the 1%. It has to be a 1%. It's always exactly 1% of the population. In the past, it included head teachers. It included people who were running successful local companies. It included your local doctor. They were in the 1%. And it included the odd banker, but not many of them. The 1% has changed now, so that other than 200 general practitioners who also happen to own pharmacies, all doctors, old doctors, are not in the 1%. Head teachers are not in the 1%. The 1%, 97% of it is people in finance or directly associated with finance in one way or another. Celebrities only make up about 2 or 3% of the 1%. There aren't actually, even though you see a lot of them on telly, there aren't actually that many celebrities. So that's not the group. It's a group that's been taken over by finance. It's a kind of become a single-minded set of people operating in the same business. It isn't a conspiracy, it isn't that a group of people set about to do this, but it has happened. And what then happens is that people begin to justify their incomes and their wealth at the top. You have to pay me this much, or I can't live in a four-bedroom house within 2 miles of where I work in Canary Wharf, and I can't send my children to that school when the school fees have gone up. You begin to get a self justification of why inequality is fine. You also get damaging effects beneath it. So people just beneath the 1% try quite hard to hold themselves up. Often they're just, again, trying to buy a house. You know, it's a head teacher wanting to buy a house within 30 minutes of the school that they're the head teacher of. And that, of course, used to be entirely possible for head teachers almost anyway. It isn't possible now in much of London and the South East. For teachers in general, where I come from in Oxford, we have a huge number of teachers who are aged under 25, because when they get to 25, they've had enough of losing all their income on rent, and they go and become a teacher somewhere else in the country. And these are the kind of examples of things that go wrong. When you say it's okay for a small number of people to have so much, because what also happens when people have this much money? You're talking annual incomes, household incomes of 200,000, an average of 330. You have a second home, or you might have a third home. And that uses up valuable housing which other people, you know, could be using, could be living in. At the very top, of course, of the 1%, you get investors. And the very top of investors buy flats in London, luxury flats, and leave them empty. So the population of Kensington and Chelsea has actually fallen in the last 10 years. I mean, it's quite remarkable. And we're getting a number of these statistics which are unprecedented. Know, things that haven't happened before, and clearly, you know, unless Kensington and Chelsea is slowly going to become some kind of empty museum, this isn't going to carry on forever.
And you've touched on it a little bit, but what are the particular changes, socioeconomic trends over the past decade, couple of decades, that have served to sort of accelerate this phenomenon?
I think for Britain, it's seeing many industries not do so well, and banking becoming our premier industry. So it's 4% of the population employed in banking and finance. It was 12% of GDP at the time of the crash. It resulted in all political parties lauding bankers, just saying how wonderful they were. We got to a point a couple of years ago, and we only know this because of European monitoring, where we had over 2,200 bankers being paid €1 million or more a year, often more. The next highest number in Europe is 197 in Germany. So it just isn't, it isn't normal to do this. The Swiss do not pay their bankers this much, they pay them half as much. And they have hardly any paid over €1 million. Once you've got 2,200 in London being paid over €1 million, you've got an even larger number being paid between 900,000 and €1 million, and then another group being paid between €800,000 equivalent, and so on. So that's part of the reason. One reason why the inequalities enlarged recently was that the pound dropped in value by 20% with the crash. But if you are an international financier, if you're somebody who moves around the world, if you're somebody who owns property in other countries, when the pound falls in value by 20%, you demand a 20% pay rise in your salary. Because all you're actually asking for, because you know about finance, you work in it, you're just asking to keep your salary the same. And so one of the reasons why we had this sudden jump in inequality recently is that people in finance were just saying, oh, please don't give me a pay cut, the pound's fallen, you're paying me in pounds, you need to pay me more.
And so on that sort of note of finance, I was asking a similar question to John Kay when we had him in this hot seat a couple of weeks ago. Why is it that society, so rather than the sort of financial savviness of those people, why is it that society rewards bankers over those head teachers and doctors, and has that sort of status symbol that is a pound sign on their paycheck?
It crept up on us. It crept up on us. We were grateful for it. I mean, if you remember, you're too young to remember. Sorry, but London, right through to the 1980s, was losing population. It was becoming shabbier. There was a lovely book called Journey Through the Ruins, written by Patrick Wright, about Dalston Junction, and who on earth is going to live in Dalston Junction. Now you can't buy a flat in Dalston Junction. Finance was seen as a kind of saviour for London, with the big bang in 1986 allowing it to do, you know, pretty much what it liked. Finance could reinvigorate areas of the capital. Finance could build you shiny new towers, while you had an industry that was failing and disappearing and not doing too well, and a country that felt it was lagging behind what it had once been. There's a lot of people in Britain who hark back to the idea of a great nation, you know, a nation that once owned half the world. And finance appeared to be a way of getting back to that, putting the great back in Britain again. And I think it has a lot to do with that. I think it has a lot to do with our pretensions to be great, our pretensions to be wealthier than other people, our experiences. Shortly after the Second World War, our standards of living were double standards of living in mainland Europe. Mainland Europe, of course, has just had troops moving back and forth over it. So people who were fairly well off in Britain watched their relative position in terms of Europe decline and slide throughout the 1940s, 50s, 60s and 70s. They lamented this. They said how terrible it was. The turnaround in the 80s for well-off people, of course the 80s were no good for most people, not for poor people, but the turnaround for well-off people, and then their rise in riches in the 90s was celebrated as a price worth paying to make Britain great again, and we could get a trickle-down from this. It didn't matter if people in finance became filthy rich, as long as they paid their taxes, as long as they hired their chauffeurs, as long as they used beauticians, we'd all be okay. And that mantra was taken up as much by New Labour as by the Conservatives. It became a hegemonic way of thinking. Finance was okay. And you don't just have a crash and bail banks out and change your mind that fast. I mean, the reputation of banking has taken a hell of a hit, but we don't have an alternative to the financial sector still as to what we're going to do. And we've just about shut down our steel industry. So again, we're looking at finance as a way forward.
So our first crisis crowdsourced question is from Mark Baxendale at Queen Mary University, and he asks, is a second crash imminent? And I've put an add on to that, and would that finally sort of serve to change things?
Would it, or what will it take? Andy Haldane, who's held various positions at the Bank of England, goes around the world. He's a relatively young, banker. Going around the world saying another crash is imminent. I think that's because he sees he's got quite a long career ahead of him, and he knows it's imminent. And he said, "The world financial system is not stable. People expect runs on the banks at some point in Europe or elsewhere. They're trying to stress test them. They're trying to make them have slightly larger deposits than the tiny deposits they have." They're trying to get into a situation where banks are not, in theory, worth more than entire nations, but we're a long way away from that. The other crash that they may be talking about, of course, is the housing market. And that is much more precarious than the banks. The housing market in this country is in a very, very strange position. All around the periphery of Europe, from Greece, Cyprus, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Iceland, Northern Ireland, all the way. House prices at one point or another have as much as halved in value. We're the only part of the periphery of Europe which hasn't seen that. Danny Blanchflower was saying 4 or 5 years ago that our housing was 30% overvalued, and that was when the values were a lot lower. So we're looking at a housing market which, the higher it goes and the faster it goes, the more dangerous it becomes, and that's well worth pointing out. We're now the most expensive large city on the planet. Every most expensive large city on the planet throughout history has had a crash shortly after the point it becomes the most expensive large city on the planet. The last famous one was Tokyo, which in the very late 1980s, early 1990s, property prices halved in value in a very short amount of time. So I would worry about the housing market. I worry about having a chancellor who introduces a stamp duty change which encourages people to buy flats as fast as they can before April next year. You know, if you're trying to engineer, you know, another acceleration, what he's actually trying to do is slow the market down, because it's gone out of sync. But it is a dangerous market. The last thing to say about the housing market is, if it isn't next year or it isn't the year after, in about 10 years' time, the first set of university students who will have the full student debt — we have 3 years of them at the moment — will have 8 years worth of students with a debt of around about 56,000 more if they're successful. Their debt will be larger. That first group of students enter the market as first-time buyers. Almost all first-time buyers in the south of England are graduates. Almost all graduates are going to have a debt. Their debt will be in proportion to their income. So their ability to borrow money to buy your house when you're retiring, if you're old, is going to be hit by that amount of debt. So it's possible it could last until then, but it's impossible without mass immigration of the rest of the world's rich to Britain. It's impossible for the housing market to carry on for 10 more years, because there isn't anybody who's got the money to buy the houses.
We've actually got two questions on housing that have been submitted, and you might be repeating a little bit. But Josh Ryan Collins from the New Economics Foundation asks, is a culture of viewing housing as primarily a financial asset rather than a place to live compatible with a high level of equality? And my colleague Rebecca McSweeney at Covey asks, do you think we put too much emphasis, both culturally and in terms of policy, on property ownership rather than making it cheaper and easier to
rent? Yes, it really has got very bad. I mean, it was very bad, I don't know, 80, 90 years ago. You've got to go back that far to find a time when we had a high number of landlords really ripping people off. And we have the highest rents in Europe. We have the lowest quality housing in Europe. There is nothing good about this. In the USA and the UK, you have this culture that investing in housing is fine. I saw Arnie Schwarzenegger talk at a conference, I think about a year ago, where he was telling a series of bankers — this is the Terminator giving bankers investment advice — he was telling about his portfolio of property ownership in California and how that's where he invests his money, in apartments that people have to pay him rent for. Now, that's fine for Arnie, It's not good for all his tenants. In a normal country, Germany is one of the normal countries in which it's 25. It's not like Scandinavia, it's not like Japan, which is much more equal. In a normal country, you do not buy property to speculate. You buy property, you do not expect it to rise in value in real terms. You buy it if you happen to like doing DIY and you want to look after it. If you don't like doing DIY, you rent. And you have secure tenancies because your government gives you laws that give you secure tenancies. You get the same in the Netherlands. You even get better property rights in New York than you get here. And far fairer property taxes as well. We are the international outlier when it comes to housing. The most ridiculous thing we do is have the lowest property taxes in the world. So if you had a flat round here, say a large flat with six bedrooms, and it was worth many, many millions, you know, within a few hundred yards of it, you'll be paying £1,300 a year council tax. You know, it's laughable, it really is. You can't find anywhere else in the world where we allow people to park their money. We don't tax them. It's as if we don't care about people not being able to house themselves in London.
Just picking up on that housing space theme, Luanne Tranchell from Hammersmith Community Trust asks, is there any chance of a new tenure for low-wage sectors, arts, agriculture, fishing, care, kids? The rising prices really create bondage, a total dominance of the cost of a roof over your head and enforced travel. Yeah. And so I think that's taking it a little bit
There's lots of, I mean, we have got new tenures. You know, shared ownership has come in as something which wouldn't be necessarily a more equal country. In a more equal country, you know, you go between full ownership and renting. You don't have to invent these new things in between. You know, we have affordable housing, which is 80% of market value, which isn't. So we've invented these. The thing you can do, and it is remarkably easy to do it, is you can change a short-hold tenancies, which is what almost all private renters have. Short-hold tenancies only apply for a year. Once they've been running for a time, you can be evicted with 2 months' notice, just 8 weeks to find somewhere. Because these are short-term contracts, a government can very, very quickly change the law, not retrospectively, but simply say, any new contracts of this kind are no longer legal. Any new short-hold tenancies will be for 3 years, or 5 years if you've got children, or if you have a child on the unit, it's 5 years. You can't put the rent up for those years. We can suddenly change tenure in this country. It's as easy as that. It's, you know, the only hard thing is you actually have to win enough seats in the House of Commons, and you have to explain to MPs that they need to do it. But the good news on that is that although a quarter of MPs are themselves landlords, they're the old MPs. Because we've changed the housing allowances for MPs, the new intake of MPs, they're not quite as badly off as most people, but they are having to rent and behave a bit more like their constituents, and they can't buy homes and swap them and end up with two or three or four like their older colleagues have. So there will come a time when we have enough new members of the House of Commons, as long as we elect people who don't have trust funds, there'll come a time when our representatives in the House of Commons will understand what the problems of their constituents are. Rather than having to do what MPs younger than me, when I talk to them about housing, they tell me, oh yes, they've talked to their researchers and they understand the problem. And it's just ridiculous that we have members of Parliament who are so shielded from housing as a problem that they don't understand it.
And so on the topic of politics and politicians, what else would it take to achieve recognition of a lot of these things in politics? We've had a hard-working families narrative around the election, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. But sort of, what does it take to actually cut through to real practical change?
It's always taken time in the past. So when the 1929 crash hit America, when it hit here, we didn't immediately recognise then our politicians that there was a problem. In America, it took 4 years before they didn't carry on trying to go back to the position before. So I would let our politicians off at least 4 years. The problem is it's, you know, now been seven. But things can change, and they are changing. One of our large parties is becoming more like a normal large left-wing European party. Okay, it's a bit of a shock for Britain. We've been used to all our parties moving to the right. Our Conservative Party has moved so far to the right, it's no longer a Conservative Party. It doesn't actually belong to the Conservative group in Europe. But the Labour Party is becoming a normal Labour Party again. to give you one example there of why our politicians didn't get the problem with the 1%, all three of our major party leaders were in the 1% at the time of the last election, by dint of the incomes of their wives, it has to be said. But the household income of Edmund Miliband, the household income of Nick Clegg, and the household income of David Cameron was way up there. So you don't have a single party leader not in the 1%. That was quite a remarkable situation to get into.
And how much of the I suppose the theory of the 1% that you present is about power and influence and cultural status, and we talk about the lobbying potential of this group?
Well, we look to America to see that. I mean, this current divergence has been very rapid, so we're only just beginning to see the worst of it in Britain. You know, people really with a large amount of money to throw around at parties. It's happened before. Certain newspapers, represented certain parties before, but it's a quite rapid change that we're getting now. In the United States, the 1% control politics. They control the vast majority of the funding for politicians. Occasionally you'll get Barack Obama and crowdfunding, but that really was an anomaly. The 1% control the adverts. The 1% also write letters to their employees telling them how they should vote. The 1% lobby politicians to get voting laws changed so that lots of people in the United States can't vote. They can't vote if they don't show ID cards of a particular kind. So you've got to be able to show driving licenses, but if you don't have a car, you don't have a driving license. If you want to see what happens if you let the 1% move away even further, in the US they take 20% of all income, here it's about 15% once you factor in tax avoidance. If you want to see what goes wrong, you just have to look to America, which has been run in many ways by plutocrats who prevent that democratically elected president from doing a lot of things that he would like to do, because they've managed to fund the takeover of the Senate and Congress. And the worry, if the United Kingdom is to carry on becoming more than equal, is we'll head towards becoming like the United States. Local authorities will have to raise all their money, like in the United States. We will not redistribute money from rich areas to poor areas, like in the United States. And you can begin to see the ways in which we are moving closer to the US currently.
Thank you. A couple of questions on education now. What changes do we need to make to the education system to negate the myth of meritocracy? And that's from Joseph Young, a research assistant who actually comes from the US. A second one has been submitted by Adam Lang. I worked for 14 years as head teacher of a London secondary school. In relation to inequality within education, do you think reinstating grammar schools is part of the solution? And if not, what would your educational policy priorities be?
The myth of meritocracy has been taken up within advocates for inequality. So they argue, the argument is that the 1% are made up of an amazing proportion of incredibly gifted people with special genes. This argument has been published. And we are lucky to have them, and they naturally rise to the top. And because they have it within them, it's a genetic potential. It's not something they've actually necessarily worked very hard to get there. In Britain, this myth has strengthened because no matter where you go to school, if you're in the top elite of society, you are made to get A's and A stars nowadays. Wasn't the case. We were much more equal in the 1970s. You could go to Eton or Westminster or Lodeen and have some fun, play sport, get lower grades, join the guards or something else. But now children in the 1% are made to get very high exam results by their schools. And this has fueled the myth of meritocracy. You have to get over to people that learning well isn't about you being naturally able to do it. It's actually about enjoying what you're doing and about hard work and the length of time. And there isn't one group who are destined to do better than others. I can go on to you endlessly about how bad we are, particularly in the UK and USA, educationally. If you look at international tests of numeracy, literacy and problem solving of those richest 25 countries in the world, you'll find that we are at the bottom of the table. So we think we have a good education system, but somehow it doesn't manage to teach our children very well compared to more equal countries. The stunning thing is that when you test children, not at 16, but when you test them later, up to age 24, we're even worse. So what's happening in the UK and the USA, under this great degree of inequality, is parents and teachers are desperately trying to get children to have the highest grade they can get them. A child who might get a C, might get a B, you try to get them an A, you try to get them a B. You don't want anybody going below a C, because you need a C to get a job. You want to get an A star to be considered by certain Russell Group universities at your GCSE. The result is that we get the A stars and we get the Cs, and we don't learn how to do maths, and we don't learn literacy. And we know that because we test people later and they can't do it. So you get a culture which is exam-driven. We now have this exam-driven culture. It's just there in what the Secretary of State for Education keeps on introducing and saying. You've got to begin by realising that passing exams and getting high marks doesn't mean you're very clever or very able or you've learned a lot. It just means you're behaving like a very well-behaved dog who can jump through hoops. And it's very hard when you've taken a country and pushed it that far along to get people to accept that. It's easy in one way. You could take a whole bunch of my students that I teach in Oxford and we could give them all a maths test now. A few years after their maths test, they wouldn't be that good at it because they were trained to pass on the day. Over schools and selection, you can see where I'm going. If I don't believe in this, I'm not going to believe in grammar schools. Grammar schools were an improvement on what we had before we introduced them. This was free secondary education with the 1944 Act. It was better that we had free secondary education, but it was divided. People should really call this the secondary modern debate, because what you're actually talking about is introducing secondary moderns. You introduce three of those for every grammar school you create. A whole generation were damned not to be able to do jobs which required them to use their mind by failing that test at 11. It was an absolute indictment. A huge volume of evidence was produced to say it was terrible. Nobody in their right mind should think of bringing in grammar schools again. I would lump it in with caning. We used to cane. It's a bad idea to cane. It wasn't until the 1990s that private schools stopped caning. Just because somebody thinks that, say, caning might be a good idea, I don't think we have to take them seriously, in the same with grammar schools. We do need to worry about our schools, but we also need to celebrate their achievements. The biggest achievement has been Inner London. So we need to learn from Inner London State Comprehensives how the hell did they manage to change around so fast. And part of that was immigration, part of it was government money, part of it was just commitment. And we're about to lose that, because it's in Inner London that all these children are now moving around because the private landlords have taken over the homes that they might live in. You need different solutions in different areas. In towns with just two or three schools, it might be a good idea to, in effect, merge those schools. You keep the same buildings on the same sites. But the worst educational results occur when, say, you have three comprehensives in a town. East Coast towns are classic to this. You have three comprehensives, and what happens under our system is one of them becomes a sink school and gets worse and worse, and the exam results diverge, the house prices between the areas pull apart, and then it's just a waste of time. So there are lots of things you can do with our education system, but it may be different in rural areas and small towns from large towns. The other thing that you have to say when you mention education is that we do not understand or know that private education is not normal. Mainland Europe doesn't have it. In Finland it's 99.5% state education and some of the best results in the world. It's not our fault we have private education, it's an historical legacy. But at the very least, understand it is not a normal thing to do. Common perception in Britain is, oh, well, they must have it in Germany, they must have it in France. They simply don't. It's not normal. In the twin town with my town of Oxford is Bonn in Germany. In Bonn there is one private school. It's the private school for the very slow boys of the extremely rich. That's what it's known as. And their most famous alumni is Prince Philip. That's a European mentality about private schools. And we've got so much to learn about education in this country. And we have got problems. Which is partly why we're at the bottom of the league tables when it comes to these sort of basic ability. And the worst thing is, we think we're ever so clever. because we give ourselves, at least some of our children get these, you know, A's and A stars. Half of all A's at A level go to 7% of children go to private schools. It has this terribly damaging effect of telling very young people that they're ever so special at a very young age.
I'm just going to take this chance to have a bit of a cough.
Yes,
I don't drop the recording. Great. So the next question is on design and architecture, so very, very, very different from what you've just been saying. What role can design and architecture play in improving living standards and well-being for their members?
I should say, being a geographer, you kind of feel that you can waffle on about anything. You're not much better at anything. I don't know much about architecture. All I would say on architecture is, it's interesting to look at architecture in more equal countries. If you look at Germany, a third of the homes in Germany are self-built. That doesn't mean people actually build them themselves. It means they commission their own builders. And you get a much higher degree of variation. I do think it's interesting to compare the variation you get in more equal countries. You'd think more equal countries would have more uniformity. But you go to towns in more equal countries and the housing looks more different. You come to Britain and of course you find council estates built in a very uniform manner. But executive home estates, I won't name the builder because I'll get in trouble, but you all know who the builders are. You know, there's those very small detached houses with four bedrooms with a little gap between them and the next detached house. I think that's the architecture of inequality. Design planning in general, I know a little bit more about. In more equal countries, they plan for a start. More unequal countries don't believe in planning, just allow people to do what they want. They plan a new zone so that people can live nearby where they work. And if they don't live nearby where they work, they can get public transport to move between them. And that's all done by design and by planning.
Tell us about health and the consequences for health or on the sort of well-being topic and particularly health and demographics maybe.
Health and demographics, what's changing? There's a book called The Spirit Level, published in 2009-10, which came about 12 things that are worse in more unequal countries. Health was the one that only just got in. It's actually got the lowest correlation. This is life expectancy. Partly because life expectancy is a reflection of your health throughout your lifetime. So if you grew up in a country like Britain, which was the second most equal large country in Europe in the 1970s, there were health benefits to that. I used to live in Sheffield, and in the 1970s, Sheffield had health which was better than national average, which people might not realise today. So that the relationship between life expectancy is generally weak, although more unequal countries have lower life expectancy. Britain's life expectancy has been rising recently, slightly faster than in similar countries nearby in Europe, but only because of immigration. It's healthy young Europeans coming to London that have actually increased our life expectancy. Mm. When you take London out and you take the young Europeans who've arrived out, and other migrants all tend to be healthier, you actually find that our health is not doing well. Life expectancy is dropping for women over 65, has been for about 3 years. It's elderly women living on their own. There's a paper, story in the paper again today saying, oh, it was the flu again last year for 40,000 deaths. We've got to ask, what kind of flu is it that kills old women and not old men? Men tend to be living in couples, so they're less affected by austerity. The more important effects of inequality are that your infant mortality rate doubles. It's twice as high in the States as it is, say, in France or in Germany. Mental health is far, far worse. About a quarter of people in the States have a mental health problem that is clinically diagnosed. We are pretty bad. 1 in 10 people in Scotland are prescribed by the NHS for the equivalent of Prozac. So you've got 1 in 10 of the population who are kind of being taken away from their situation in their mind. Those rates of mental ill health and antidepressant use go down and down in more equal countries. And perhaps the most interesting thing about that, about mental ill health, is that the drug taking, the pill popping, is highest amongst the most affluent. So it's highest in Los Angeles and it's highest in Beverly Hills in Los Angeles. So the well-off are not separated from these problems. They might be able to afford private health care that will keep their body alive for longer towards the end, but they will not get good mental health by living in an unequal country with an enormous amount of wealth. They're a very hard group to study, they're very well off, but they do not look like a particularly happy group of people. And if that's true, that's really important, because so many people aspire to be in that group. Then what is it that you're aspiring to? What kind of relationships do people have in a very wealthy family? Can you have an argument with your mum and dad if you're relying on inheritance from them? Whereas in a family where there is no money to inherit, you can actually tell your mum and dad what you think of them, and they can tell you what they think of you. Imagine having to get a prenup when you got married. You know, I love you, I want to marry you, by the way, can you sign this bit of paper in case I don't love you anymore in the future? I mean, that's not a problem that most people in Britain have.
And I think in the book you do talk about the sort of the generation of people growing up with an interest in their parents' debts, you know, just because that's the only way that they can afford a house.
Yeah, that's wider. That's the upper middle class as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, does this sort of rhetoric where we divide society into segments sort of fuel a culture where we pit people against each other and pit the old against the young, and you mentioned that those at the bottom of the top 1% don't look down. So, yeah. You know, how are we dividing society?
Yeah. I think this is the most interesting side of all of this. We have an equality tax at the moment which has a series of protected groups. They're called protected groups, so, you know, men and women. People of different sexualities, race, and we worry about all these kind of inequalities. There were reports a few years ago with titles like Parallel Lives about how people who are Muslim and not Muslim in different towns are living separate lives. The real parallel lives are by income and wealth. The only groups that absolutely don't mix are the very, very rich with the just rich, with the average, with the poor, and with the very, very poor. They live in separate parts of the city. That separation is increasing, they go to separate schools, they even go to separate nightclubs. It's about the one place you might think you get mixing, but there's a social hierarchy of nightclubs. And it leads to all kinds of different behaviour. So international tests about trust find that our level of trust is much lower. So we worry about crime all the time, which you do not have to worry about in other countries. In Japan, in the poorest part of Japan, I went to visit. I asked some academics if they could take me there, and they said, don't be stupid, you can just go on your own, which you'd never do to a visiting Japanese academic in Britain. You know, I wouldn't give them the postcode of the day most, you know, poorest area and say, go on, and I'll visit. I went to the poorest part of Japan, half the bikes were not locked up. It is truly incredible the differences you get between different countries. And when you have greater equality, it allows you to stop worrying about your children's school. They can just go to the nearest school, which means they can be friends with children on the same street that you live in. You stop worrying about where you get your home. You buy or rent your house in a place that's convenient for you, not because somebody on Channel 4 has told you location, 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 you must buy here. You know, it's a completely ridiculous way of behaving. You don't have to choose your friends to fit in with your lifestyle, because otherwise it'll be embarrassing, because they won't be able to buy a drink in the place you go to, or God forbid you decide to get together and they have to meet your family, and then it'll all be a bit uncomfortable. We're heading back to the 1920s in terms of the inequalities between us in wealth and income. In the 1920s is when they tried to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover, and that book could only be told because of the difference between her and her gardener. That book could be published in the 1960s, because by the 1960s those gaps no longer existed, so the book wasn't actually so close to the bone. And when a judge said, is this a book you would like your wife and servants to read, a jury could say, we haven't got servants, you know. And that was a much more equal world in the 1960s. We're heading back to that division again. We're heading back to a world of servants, in the world of nannies, and the world of chauffeurs, and the world even of bottom-end bankers earning only £200,000 a year having to fly around the world making money for people who are 10 or 20 times richer than them, who look down at their bankers who are in the 1% in a way that those bankers might look down at people who are earning 10 times less than them, who look down at people who are cleaning their offices or don't even notice them when they come in and clean.
Does individualism fuel that sort of culture, or has that culture fueled individualism? Which way round?
Which way does it go? It inevitably goes both ways. People who are more individualistic are attracted to unequal countries. So we have a huge influx of very get-up-and-go young people from the rest of Europe, some of whom are actually a bit sick of growing up in their much more, you know, safe and boring equal part of the world. You know, they want a chance to make it. You can start a firm here for almost, it doesn't cost you anything to start a company here. If you try and start a company in Germany, you'd be amazed at how much paperwork you have to fill in and how much you have to pay. So more individualistic people are attracted to more unequal places. They think they can make it. There are also many more opportunities in unequal places for people. There are many more jobs at the bottom, and there's more space at the top. In a more equal country, there isn't much space at the top because people don't drop out of it, and also the top isn't that high up. And there isn't space at the bottom because you don't employ people at really low wages, because you wouldn't do that. So those kind of bottom-end jobs don't exist. You get more immigration in more unequal countries. But then, once you have a culture of inequality, once it's seen as okay to have these differences, you begin to get the mantra of, if you just work hard enough, if you just try hard enough, you can get up there. It's called the tadpole philosophy. A philosopher, political scientist called Tawney in the 1930s christened this. The tadpole philosophy is that you're a big fat frog on a rock, all the tadpoles are down there in the pool, and you just tell all the tadpoles, you know, if you work hard enough and grow your legs and climb up here, you can be on the rock like me, hoping that the tadpoles are so innumerate that they can't work out that they can't all fit on the rock. Levels of innumeracy are highest in the United States and the UK, and it's the United States and the UK where the highest proportions of people say they're going to get in the 1%. And the key thing is that only 1% can be in the 1%. You're always going to have a 1%. Rather than aspire to be in the 1%, you need to aspire to control your 1% so they're not too greedy. And then they can even be helpful. Tawney was in the 1%. He went to rugby school. He was a rich lad. He was brother-in-law of William Beveridge, who was also in the 1%. But these were useful members of the 1%. At times in our history, members of the 1% have actually helped make the country a more equal place to their own benefit. But they had sharp things to focus their mind. The Russian Revolution helped the 1% work out it might be a good idea to make Britain a bit more equal.
And I think that is the perfect segue into the final two pre-submitted questions I have, so that's great. And then if everyone can just get thinking about the ones that you're going to ask. So Alistair Murray from Housing Justice asks, how can we as a society incentivise behaviour that leads towards the common good, especially among the wealthier and more powerful, so the incentives there? And finally, what policies could we take from other countries to reduce economic inequality in the UK? And that's from Natalie Beale at The Guardian.
Okay. On incentives, there's at least two kinds. One kind is not being impressed. Stop being impressed anymore. Clive James began this in 2009. Clive James, poor man, 14, was about to die in 2009. He's still alive. In 2009, he wrote that conspicuous consumption has gone out of fashion like the codpiece. And that helps a lot, but that degree of not being lauded for having become rich helps. However, there always will be greedy people. Some people are less pro-social than others, it may even be innate. And the 1% will always include a disproportionate proportion of the greedy. So you have to control in other ways. And the key way is things like high marginal rates of taxation. Piketty and his colleagues in America showed this. A high rate of marginal taxation is not put in to raise money. The Tories don't get this. The reason why you might have a 60% tax rate on a million, a 65% on an income of 2 million, a 70% on 3 million, say, is so that the bank doesn't carry on paying people more and more, because otherwise it's handing over the money straight to the government. It's a way of telling it, actually pay people to work in your banks locally rather than pay the people in Canary Wharf as much. That helps. For other countries, there are, I mean, the great thing is that we're not Norway or Sweden. There are so many places we can go and look. It's wonderful. We can look at Utrecht in the Netherlands. If you want to see what you do on welfare, they're bringing in a basic income in Utrecht and testing it scientifically. Half the welfare recipients are getting a basic income. That's an income you receive without question. The very opposite to our million people being sanctioned. You could look at Sweden and Stockholm for work, where they're moving to a 6-hour day, but you're still paid for 8 hours because they found out that people actually do more in 6 hours than they would in eight, which makes life a lot more livable. You can look to the United States for things to do in housing in London. We could have a flat property tax like they have in New York, and the same property tax across all of London, say, rather than paying half as much council tax here than you pay in Barking and Dagenham. You know, New York is not a socialist republic, it's New York, it's just that we're so extreme. We can look to Finland for their schools. We can look at Japan for recycling. You know, the nice thing about our position is that there isn't a lack of examples of somewhere else in the rich world that's doing a better job than us. It doesn't mean that we're bad at everything. There are some things that we are good at. We are a particularly cosmopolitan society. We do have lower levels of racism than many of these other countries. That's partly because of our history. But in many things, it's being done better somewhere else. And we have a kind of pig-headedness that means that we don't think it can be done better. Or if we do decide to go for lessons, and Gordon Brown did this every year, we fly to the United States to see how they do it. And their property taxes are good, but incarcerating 2 million people isn't good. Their life expectancy isn't good. You know, their education system isn't good. So why we went to the United States for lessons of how to do things, rather than it's much cheaper to go in the other direction. And there are many other ways we could go to look. Or lastly, if you really want to see how to run a very large city of millions and millions of people without cars, with them living to a very old age, with very high educational output, with fewer people paid over £1 million in the whole country than Barclays pay in that tower, you can go and look at Tokyo and Japan. We don't even think of comparing ourselves to Japan or learning lessons from Japan. And Japan is one of the most equal countries in the rich world.
Thank you. Right. Time for our questions from the floor. I'll take them in batches so that you can sort of have a break from the speaking. Do we have any questions, please? Yes, at the front.
I enjoyed that very much, thank you. The last part of the quote was from the book was that the rich don't get it. And I'm wondering whether the rich do get it. Despite your evidence suggesting that the rich they are, that their happiness doesn't improve. They are, in many respects, happy to be rich, glad to be rich, and enjoying being rich in all sorts of ways. And their wealth increasing at the rate that it is fine by them. I worry about the ability of billionaires to control the news media in this country. I think that may have something to do with a lack of political will. To do more about this big problem, I worry that the ideologues that are on the far right, you said the Conservatives move further to the right, have a lot of mates who are extremely rich, and they do get it, and it's fine by them, and if they can distract, and there's all sorts of things going on in the world that provides distraction. Making the case that we have to dismantle the BBC is I find berserk. But in some respects, I'm not surprised, and I just sort of wanted to sort of question that quote and that idea that they don't get this is not good for them because it's actually serves them very well.
Take a couple more.
Let me do that one because my memory's not that good. That's complicated. There are certainly a large group of people amongst the very rich who do have that agenda, and they have their supporters and they fund think tanks which come out with bile in some cases, with very nasty kind of stuff about the supremacy of people at the top. In most other rich, in every other rich country, there are members of the very rich who say there's a problem, like Warren Buffett saying it's wrong that he pays less tax than his secretary, or the head of Royal Dutch Shell saying he worked for half as much. I think we're the only rich country in the world which doesn't have a single rich person who comes out and says that there is a problem. I talked to an anthropologist recently who managed to actually kind of study the very rich. And the most interesting thing she told me, interesting to me, was that when they go out through restaurants and so on and they're walking to a car, and these are people with families of 30 million, they don't look at the people next to the car in exactly the same way as you will not look at the person who is sleeping in the tube station tonight. You'll notice a sleeping bag there, but you'll deliberately try not to look at their face because it'll make you upset tonight. And for the very rich, we are those people. And that's quite a shock to suddenly realise that we are their nightmare. You know, having to live like us, having to go out to work, you know, at 8:30 in the morning, having to have a mortgage. What's that? Mortgages are for the little people. And you often hear politicians from the very rich talk about mortgages, and you suddenly realise they're talking about for people beneath them. And of course you know that you have to be incredibly well off now to get a mortgage if you're in a different group. The don't getting it is Bill Gates. So there's a lovely book called No Such Thing as a Free Lunch, which was published a couple of months ago, about Bill Gates. Bill wants to go down in world history of having been a wonderful person. He's not doing the right thing to do that. You can look at philanthropists in the past who are actually now remembered more for the things that they did nastily when they broke the strikes of their workers and so on than for the libraries they built. If Bill wants to be remembered in 200 or 300 years' time for having been helpful, vaccinations for children are not enough. You have to help countries build healthcare systems, and you can't do that through charity. So the not getting it, I think, is part of the... They don't realise that they... William Beveridge will be remembered for longer. Tawney will be remembered for longer, I think. Who do you remember with any warmth from the past who actually promoted inequality? You know, all the people remember from warmth, it doesn't matter, suffragettes, you can go right through it. You know, there's kind of one group which has Attila the Hun at one edge of it. And there's another group of the nice folk in history. And the nice folk were on the sides of not dividing people. And that's, I think that's there also. It's very difficult, I think, if you are in this group to know what to do. Partly, of course, because you won't mix with other people. Private schooling is absolutely essential in the 1%. You are very strange in the 1% if you send your child to a state school. And if you do, it'll be an ever so posh state school. So you're cut off from other views and opinions. You think of yourself as a public servant if you're a politician from the 1%. You know, if you become Prime Minister or Chancellor of the Exchequer or Home Secretary, you're taking a pay cut on what you could otherwise have got in the city. You're making a sacrifice. You're doing it for the good of all of you. Why do you have to do it? Because you're superior. You know better things. So it's not that they are sitting there going, you know, I really want to screw the rest of the world. They're sitting there going, I'm particularly talented, I'm a wealth creator, I make things better. The stupid people don't get it, but hey, that's because they're stupid. If they weren't stupid, they'd be as rich as me. It's a different kind of mindset, I think. Yeah.
But my worry is that's kind of it. I mean, they think they're right. Their values are different. Their experience are different. Their experience shape their values. They've worked.
Okay. But the other thing to say is that the day is not a day. There's more inequality within the 1% than there is in the other 99%. Mm-hmm. So this is not a cabal of people who have a particular. You know, they don't all meet on yachts in the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. partly because they couldn't all fit on yachts in the Mediterranean. Most of the 1% worry incredibly about their children's future, which is why they spend so much money on their children, because they're worried about what will happen to them. we don't in Britain, we have a 1% at the moment who are the least helpful 1% in the rich world. That there is some small committee of the rich that does hand out money to nice organisations and does it in secret. But if I call them the Committee of the Rich, they actually have a name, but I've forgotten what it is. So whenever you see the Equality Trust funded or the Fight Against Arms Trade and so on, there is a group. But because this is Britain, they actually have to keep themselves secret because the other very rich people would really look down on them for it. We do have a rich that is peculiarly unhelpful in Britain. But then we invented class structure. You know, there are reasons as to why we are as dysfunctional as we are, not least of which is having been the richest country on the earth 100 years ago. You can't adjust from that. You can't adjust from your forebears owning slave plantations and your dad being a major stockbroker to you just become a PR man for Carlton TV. You know, it's a big drop down. And there are lots of excuses as to why we are so unusual, why our 1% is so divided, why there is a lack of solidarity in this country. You get solidarity in wars. I mean, one reason why Tawney did what he did is he spent 24 hours in no man's land, severely injured. Yeah. And the First World War did bring people together in some ways, even though the generals were behind the line. The Second World War brought them men and women back in Britain together. Disasters and other things going wrong do bring people together. But you don't want to have to hope for a disaster. You are getting one for the young. This is the other thing that happened in the past. After 1929, the young no longer trusted their parents. Their parents had got it completely wrong, and even worse than the banking system their parents believed in. Their parents, despite having had a world war, mucked things up so much that they were going to send them in to another one. That young generation in the 30s helped bring us equality. We are now doing a brilliant job of mucking up the prospects of the young across a wide range of society. We're doing it so well that even if you're pretty well off, even if you've managed to get yourself a fairly good job and you're 28 or 29 in London, you're not going to be able to get a mortgage. Well, if you can get a mortgage, you know, if mum and dad will give you £100,000, you know you might just buy that little flat in Dalston Junction for £600,000 at exactly the wrong time. And it'll drop in value by 200,000. Now, it's in designed, and it's not much, it's not like a war, but what we have done to people under 35 has created things like Generation Vent as a pressure group, the Intergenerational Foundation as a pressure group, Priced Out as a pressure group. And these are pressure groups that go, but they're more on the affluent side of society than the poor side. And you can make an argument about climate change, it just doesn't feel immediate enough like a war. It might take another crash. It might take a healthy crash or a banking crash or some other disaster before we properly begin to turn. And I think the real evidence of turning is when you begin to get people from within the 1% talking against inequality. And we haven't got there yet.
We've not got that much time left, so let's try and squeeze a few more in, and I'll write them down in case. So we have a hand in the middle over there, please.
Thanks. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? Are we heading away from dystopia and heading to, or can we head towards utopia? Are we capable of doing that? Towards a better phrase. And you've already referenced, I think, already potential trigger points. What might be that trigger point to head in the right direction? Is it a house price crash? Is it an emergency general election? Does it have to be an externality, a disaster?
Okay. There's one, yes, gentleman.
Yeah. To what extent is the enormous focus on property the solution itself? Because I remember my father telling me, you can do a lot of things with a house, but unless you're in Australia, you generally can't move it. And so in effect, the very wealthy people have left themselves enormously exposed by in effect parking their properties in lock up and leaves in bricks in Chelsea because they're totally accessible.
Yeah.
Thank you. And yes, there's a hand, I can't really see it, but over there, yes.
You talked about the 1% and you've talked a couple of times about private education. Are you aware of the work of psychotherapists like Nick Duffel, who talks about, there's this phenomenon of boarding school survivors. And can you comment about that? Because that highlights the psychology that the pathological psychology is produced by the boarding school, and which is concentrated among our leaders.
Yes. Okay.
And if you don't mind, I'm sure our audience doesn't mind if you swivel back this way, just so that we can put it on the internet.
Okay. I'll do it to you. I'm a short-term pessimist. I'm a real pessimist in that I'm not a revolutionary, and I can see terrible things happening in a short-term crisis and people going very hungry and so on. I'm a long-term optimist, mainly because I've worked in universities almost all my adult life, which is over 25 years now, taught hundreds of thousands of students, and I don't believe you can send half your young women to university as we do now and con them. So I don't think we're going to get Blade Runner. I don't think that the most popular job in Britain is going to be for women, it's going to be a servant, which it was for their great-grandmothers. I do think we are collectively going to change it. Part of the changing it will be not noticing it's changing because we carry on being angry it's so bad. And that's how it changed in the past. I'll give you one example. Norway has the lowest child poverty rate in the world. I talked to an audience in Norway a few years ago and started making a mistake by saying congratulations on having the lowest child poverty rate in the world. Somebody shouted out, it's too high. And it's that attitude that gets you the lowest child poverty rate in the world. The second question was about property. This is a huge advantage, the fact that the property is here, which means that we can tax it. We can start off introducing just a few more bans on council tax, a London-wide property tax. All the money could be spent in London. You just stop central government subsidising London in other ways as much. We could have a New York-style property tax. We can do more, and it simply can't be taken away. Occasionally, very rich people do demolish their homes in a fit of pique, and it really is only a few. People's, and I think it's well worth looking at that. You know, people say, how can you introduce rent regulation? Landlords won't rent out their property. Well, what else are you going to do with them? You know, fill them with flowers? You know, it doesn't make any sense. So that needs looking at. It's begun. George Osborne has introduced capital gains tax since April 2015 on non-done property purchases. You know, so the man who began it was George Osborne. But I don't think George... Unless George has a really cunning plan. You know, really cunning. Let's make the housing market go high, crash, and then we'll get that revolution that 14-year-old Gideon always planned for before he changed his name. So he opens on these next. I'm not helping you. But no, we are beginning. I mean, and he's done it on reducing tax rate for buy-to-let landlords in the budget. He's done it with the stamp duty changed again today. You know, there are measures that are beginning under this government that could well simply be increased and accelerated. And a wealth tax is what we need. And 60% of the wealth in this country is held in poverty. As soon as you get house prices falling, as soon as you get a wealth tax, if you're sitting in a large house on your own, you're lonely and you can't heat it, the faster you sell your house and get out to a smaller house, the more money you make. And that's a well-functioning economic market. You know, you shouldn't have people sitting in things they don't want that are going up in value. The market ought to get people into the right-sized property. The boarding schools thing is interesting. It's tragic. Boarding school head teachers constantly tell me that was in the past. They're great now. I completely expect to end my days reading stories about how terrible boarding schools are right now, and people in the future saying how bad it was to be in them. But they're small, and they're declining for the British-born population. They're filling up with international boarders because we're becoming a boarding school place for the world. The saddest thing I see in some of the top boarding schools and day schools, and sometimes they're combined, are the pupils being taught at 10 o'clock at night, particularly boys, because the boys all have to get A's and A stars at everything, and it's a form of torture. And if it wasn't that some of the richest children in the country were being treated in this way, social services would come in and stop it. And that is the top private schools around London teaching and cramming at 8, 9 and 10 o'clock at night in the sixth form to get their A stars and A's, particularly for the boys. You know, and it's you'd have to pay me a lot of money to send any of my children there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we've got time for just one last round of questions, if anyone else has anything to ask. Yes, the third row, please.
Yeah, I was interested, you talked a lot about structural kind of solutions, so kind of things like tax rates, high marginal tax rates, also lots about kind of attitudinal, I guess, kind of solutions of people in the top 1% themselves change their attitude. I was wondering, what do you think in terms of kind of bottom-up entrepreneurial kind of solutions from, not necessarily in the top 1%, but within the rest of society?
What can people do themselves?
Any other questions just before? And yes, the last question from the front, thank you.
You talk lots about myths, and you tear away a lot of these myths in your book. The economic sort of myth of growth, which is sort of tearing the planet apart, is so completely accepted within our media, and constantly every day on the news, every time they're doing an economic report or a finance report, it's always about that we have to constantly grow our company. We have to, and it's never questioned. And about shift, I mean, to me, it feels like this is something which it urgently needs addressing, that people stop and say you don't have to, that also we bucket it up as a success story, that the property prices are going up because that means that we've got our growth for that bit of time.
The two are related over what you can do and the growth myth. We can't all do this because you've got to be mildly well off to do it, but you can just buy less. So we spend twice as much of our GDP on advertising than they do in mainland Europe. In America it's twice as much again, so people are being bombarded with messages to buy things. So your average item of clothing is only worn 12 times. Buying less, not participating. There's a lot of other things you can do. You can campaign for 20 mile an hour limits, which are about having more equality in your local area and so on. But lots of small things you can do. Growth is seen as so important because if you're in the top 0.1%, your investments have to make 10% a year to stay in that group. You've got to remember that the top 1,000 families have doubled their wealth in the last 5 years. You don't stay in the top 1,000 families unless you have enormous growth of your money. So this growth mantra comes from the very top. I read a proposal today. This was a progressive proposal to change housing rules in London for 3-year tenancies, but the rent would go up by 3% a year. Why 3%? I mean, you know, people's incomes aren't going up by 3%. 3% was seen as something nice to do to tenants, just 3% rises. But consuming less, you know, is mentally hard, but saves you money, makes your life easier. And then just many, many small actions. It doesn't matter what they are, doesn't matter what kind of campaign you might want to get involved in, or just writing a letter, or just saying something at Christmas to a relative who says, you know, oh, but they do help us. You know, just rather than be polite, you know, just saying that they do. That's how attitudes change, and you can see that in the past. You can see how attitudes in this country changed. Oswald Foulkes was a banker, and his best friend, one of his best friends, was John Maynard Keynes. And he said to John Maynard Keynes once, you know, what you really did wasn't produce a great new economic theory. You know, that theory might not have worked or whatever. What you did was you helped change the moral sentiment of the country. And the moral sentiment changes collectively. It's not something that any one individual owns. Mm-hmm. So it changes by people, the presenters, if you watch I'm addicted to watching the people who talk about the newspapers at 11 o'clock at night on telly. I don't know. People who do that have learned to pretend that, sometimes they are normal nowadays, but they've learned to pretend that the aspects of their lives that are over average because they're better paid, they've learnt not to talk about them. And that's a change, and it's a change in the moral sentiment to happen. But you can contribute this. Don't get so obsessed by your children's exam results. You know, if you want them to go to university, they're going to go to university. Well, we've got lots of universities. They don't have to go to university. It's not going to get them a good job. Well, if they do go, they don't have to go in Britain. They can go for free in much of the rest of Europe. So why on earth are you sending them to a British university? Apart from the fact that we spend more on marketing our universities than the whole of the rest of the continent put together. Mm. And why are we spending money marketing our universities? Could it be that there might be a good reason for you not to pay £9,000 to go to one in this country? But why not try and travel? Why not get a job for a bit? Because the 99% is becoming more equal, and because you're not going to get into that 1%, you might as well not try and get into the 1%. You might as well try and understand and enjoy life more, get less het up, buy less, and constantly help the people who are trying to control the 1% control them. The successful countries in the world have controlled their 1%. They don't control themselves because the rich are not like us. But you have to control them, but part of that is not aspiring to be with them. And it's a long way to go. That's why I call it a slow revolution. But it's a change in what impresses you, what you're aiming for, what you think is good and what you think is benevolent and what you think is helpful and what you think you should be impressed by. We are some way on that road already. I can remember 2005-06 and newspaper shops of bankers buying a glass of champagne for £10,000 and partying not far from here. That kind of thing doesn't happen more. The top salary banker earns half as much as they earned in 2005-06. The bloke who earned that much has had to go to America and isn't paid as much as he used to be. The head of the BBC. BBC is great. It would be great if it could be kept public. But the head of the BBC is paid half as much as the head of the BBC was paid 5 or 6 years ago. You know, we could be on the beginning of this change in various ways, but you have to keep up being very angry with what it's like, because we are almost the most unequal country in the rich world, and America is actually improving slightly compared to us. And it's like that person in Norway, you know, just because you have the lowest rate of child poverty in the world doesn't mean it's low enough. Mm. Well, I'll give you a last example. You know, in Sweden, they have a target for road traffic accidents which is zero, and they actually want nobody to die on the road. We can't imagine that. We do a cost-benefit analysis and work out whether it's worth investing in something against how much we value people's lives. And the price we put on people's lives, it's 4 times less than the price of a life worth on the European continent, because that's the kind of country we've become. And so we've got to begin to change it. But the other thing, the thing I haven't talked about enough, is the things that we're good at. And you do need to begin to celebrate some of the things that you're good at. We're currently the California of Europe. We're attracting more people than anywhere else. And that isn't all bad. So what do we do about that? We go and moan about it. But we should start celebrating the fact that we do have a language that half the world can speak. You know, the weather isn't so bad, it puts people off. We do have a sewer system, the road and the housing, the rail system that can accommodate more people. We could build more apartments over tube stations in London. We could take a bigger population. We could become the most dynamic place in Europe, the most interesting place to be. We could change some of our cities to be some of the greenest. We could beat Freiburg in Germany, you know, and build houses around the edge of Oxford, which you could only cycle in and out of into the city. So all kinds of things we could do, but we can't do any of it at the moment because the 1% costs so much. You have to give them 15% of all income, and you can't raise taxes, so we have the lowest taxes in Europe because the 1% don't like the idea of more taxes. And so that, you know, I'm optimistic about a utopia or getting towards something more utopic, but there's no way of getting all these things that would be so much better and having the most unequal society in the continent. It's not possible.
Danny, thank you so much. It's an absolutely fascinating discussion. Thank you all to the audience for being here tonight and asking your questions, and thank you to everyone else who pre-submitted questions. And yeah, really, really enjoyed having you, and we'll be sharing the video so that you can share it with everyone else afterwards. So if you join me in thanking Danny.